Wait till I get up to the chair. It's a Barstool, isn't it?
Ah, heaven. Some of you might wonder why I have a wheelchair and all this business around me. I had a stroke 5 years ago, and I'm trying to pick up the pieces as best I can. Ah, that's the first time I ever turned one down. And I'll go to that later on in the story, but it has been a very enlightening procedure. I went to Al-Anon because I had a husband who was 10 days sober. And, but I must admit, I qualified a long time before that. My mother was a bad daily drunk, and when I was about 6 or 8 years old, I noticed that we weren't doing things as a family anymore. We used to go fishing and hunting, and I even had a 22 at age 8 that I used to use hunting. And we were in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and so that was a thing to do. And my father always was behind me, but still. And we just weren't doing this thing anymore. And I told her I thought it had to do with her drinking. And she said, nah. And he said, well, maybe. And so she tried to stop, and she didn't really try very hard, and she went right on drinking. Well, I became daddy's little girl, and like I didn't have a mother. And when I was about 15, I had to talk to daddy about his drinking because he was drinking as hard as she was. She was a daily drunk, and he was a periodic. And boy, it's rough to keep up with those people. And both doing things and different things, I don't know. I had a hard time following them. So my older brother, who was 4 years ahead of me in school, went off to college. He didn't seem to mind at all their drinking. And I just worried to death. And I went to New Hampshire, and we were living in upstate New York then. And I thought, well, if I go to college and I'm out of the house, I won't worry about it. Wrong. When you're out of the house, you worry about it twice as much because you don't know what's happened. And so between my sophomore and junior year, I decided to go to Europe, and that way I would definitely forget about the fact that they were drinking. And I mentioned to Dad that I'd like to go, and he said, that's fine, I bought you a car. And he said, but I'm going to bring back the car. You either get the car or you go to Europe, but you don't do both. And I said, well, I guess I go to Europe. And so I never did see the car. It went out the driveway, and that was it. And it was good because I went to Europe and studied in Norway for summer. And it's funny, but I'd call home, and I could still tell. I'd say, you've been drinking. And they say, can't we drink at all in peace? We sent you to Europe so we could drink in peace, and look what you're doing. And so I said, oh, well, you don't do it right. And anyway, when I graduated from college, I went to work in a small town. Oh, it's not small, it's big. Binghamton, New York. And I met Mr. Wonderful in Binghamton, New York. And we went out on a couple of dates, and I told him that I wanted to pay my own way, and he said, why? I'm asking you out. Why pay your own way? I said, well, because I don't like you, then I can drop you. I paid my way. And that lasted for almost a year, and then we were married, and no argument after that. We were married, and in the next 5 years, we had 4 kids. And so somebody had to slow down their drinking. And it was me. And I drank, but I drank always so I could find 1, 2, 3, 4. And by the time we eventually got to New Hampshire, moved to New York, no. See what I mean?
Don't worry.
I get names and places mixed up, and I repeat them several times, so just ignore me as I go on. And so anyway, we went to New Jersey, and but I want to tell you a story. It sums up the way I was, really. Bob was drinking, but I wasn't noticing. It wasn't any great amount. And I had the three boys, 1, 2, and 3, and was expecting a fourth, the fourth being a girl, thank God. But anyway, I had three boys. And Bob was coming in on a Friday night plane, and I had a girlfriend named, I can't remember her name, but I said, can I take care of your two sons, and you two go away and have a nice weekend? It was with their anniversary or something. And she said, well, that would be fine, but you've got 1, 2, and 3 sons, ages, and mine are 4 and 5. I said, well, I think 5 kids is, what's the difference between 4 and 3 and 5? So I got her kids. Well, I had bought a St. Bernard puppy while Bob was away. And he knew it. He knew about the puppy, but he was 8 months old.
The puppy, yeah.
Was 8 months old and weighed about 80 or 90 pounds. And I had 4 or 5 kids. And so we went to the airport to pick Bob up. Big signs all over the place. No dogs allowed. And I went right through. They just backed off. I mean, they made room for me. And so we went to the gate. And in those days, you had a gate, and you got off the plane and walked across the one runway and went in. And so all these people kept coming in. And I said to the children, remember, this is your dad. And the two said, the oldest one said, no, he's not. I said, just make believe. We're going to play a game on him. And so at the end of the plane, the last two get off, probably finishing their drinks, I don't know. Off the plane, Bob and his man and the flight attendants. And the kids went dashing out, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And the dog looked around, and he thought it was great, and he decided to go too, and he went tearing out after the kids, and I went flying after the dog, and the stewardess just looked at him like, oh, God, how could you leave this woman with these kids? And little did they know. Little did I know at the time. But anyway, so we went to New Jersey, and then we came out here to New York, to California. And I got off the plane and said, I'm home. I like the warm weather. I hate the cold weather. I'm home. And I began to make Northridge my home. And 10 minutes?
You're fine.
And so he gave me a watch. See, I've got one here, but it's not all right. Anyway, we came to California, and the kids loved it. They were in grades 1 to 7, 1 to 5, and the boys started swimming, and they were going to be. I was going to have 4 blonde teenagers, and they were going to grow up here and be happy forever. And that didn't happen. What happened was The oldest one, that comes last. We went to, we used to go to Disneyland a lot, and because we couldn't find other places that were as entertaining. And at Disneyland, I always counted, he counted four kids, and I counted five. I just knew that Bob was at the head, then there were four kids, and then there was me picking up the rear, you know? And we go through everything. And that's the way we proceeded to go through L.A. And I was there for about a year and decided I wanted to get my master's. And I went to, I actually was going to take a course in California history. And I rode my bike over to Cal State Northridge, and I rode my bike back 2 hours later, and I was in the master's program of psychology, and I didn't know why. And I guess I wanted to be ready in case somebody said, now is the time, you know? And he was sleeping on the living room floor. The kids were stepping over him to watch television or do anything, and then they'd step over him and say goodnight and go to bed. And I was a wreck. I was, when my father died in
Forget the year.
Okay. When my father died, I went back east to bury him, and we didn't know how my mother was going to survive alone, and she was crippled and in a handicap and in a wheelchair. And what happened was we were back 3 months later, and my brother had come up from Florida, and because she had fallen, and she broke her ankle in several places and was in the hospital. And he was home with his son, and we pulled up in the driveway in the motorhome. And suddenly, it dawned on me. He came out and he met us, and we enjoyed the visit the first day, and then the second day I spent looking at him, and after that I knew. He was an alcoholic too. And so my whole family at that point were alcoholics, and Bob was sleeping in the kitchen floor, in the living room floor. And so I made up my mind when our youngest, who was then a young girl, 15, I was going to wait until she was 18, give her an 18th birthday present of putting her father, everybody part of the party, and then I was going to serve notice on Bob to get out, because we'd raised the four kids, we'd done everything we could, and I didn't need him anymore. And I lived for 3 years like that. And every time we talked, he was drunk. It just didn't matter. And so what happened was, through no means of mine or anything else, in 1981, Bob got sober and sort of ruined my plans. But ten days later, I went to Al-Anon, and I've been in Al-Anon ever since. I did several things in Al-Anon, and I'll hit on them just briefly, and then I want to go into the period since I've had my stroke. I was very active in Al-Anon. I chaired four conventions. I served in a couple of capacities, including historian for Southern California, and I was... alternate delegate when I got my stroke. And My Al-Anon history is a lot like you've heard, like you. I went to meetings. I love meetings. I went to conventions with Bob. We did everything together, and our life was so beautiful. And then in June of 91, I had a massive stroke, and I didn't know Bob for 12 days. Now, if any of you have heard him laughing at a meeting, you know immediately what he did. But I didn't know who he was. I finally said to the nurse, "Who is this guy? He comes for breakfast, he comes at lunch, he comes for dinner. He wants to eat all the time, he eats what I don't eat." And and I don't know him. And she said, "Well, it's my experience that there are only two people who follow people through their stroke." And I said, "Yeah, well, what are they?" And she said, "Well, the first is people who owe you money." And I said, "Me money?" And she said, "No, you owe money." I said, "Well, I don't have any money." She said, "Well, there's another one." And she said, "What's that?" And she said, "That's a husband." And I said, "For me?" I was 41 years married at that time, but I didn't recognize the guy I was married to. So I looked him over, and we went to a couple of meetings. And since then, I've decided he is. What happened at those meetings? Well, the first 20 years in Al-Anon, I really enjoyed. I was a good person. I was a good Al-Anon. I had a lot of people I sponsored, and it was good for me. And then all of a sudden, it was blank. And then it took me a year to go back to my first meeting. And when I did, I didn't know for sure if I wanted to be an Al-Anon. I went through everything a newcomer does now. And and I heard them saying, "If you leave us, don't leave forever. Come back." And I just kept saying, I don't know if I want that." And then gradually I began to think, "Gee, I really do want it." And I began to listen to the newcomers, and the newcomers were crying the same cry I did. You know, maybe Bob only had alcoholism, and they had a whole bunch of things, but everybody had problems, and they sounded real, and they were, what do I want to say? God gave me the opportunity to listen instead of speaking, and I learned how to listen and act interested, and I learned how to be interested and to spend time with the people who I really care about. And a lot of that meeting is my Monday noon meeting. I love it. It's 18 or 20 people, but I know each one of them and each one of their problems. And I can't answer for them. I don't have wonderful answers, but I can help them through some things. And it's a different aspect of AA that it's like I've taken it to step backwards and I come forwards at the same time. I think it's wonderful. I speak only at conventions, occasionally at meetings, but generally this is... what do I want to say? I don't know. But I thank God to give me this opportunity to see the newcomer again, to see how they feel, to feel with them. I gave up my world service job, and I thought I was going to be delegate. And I didn't know whether I wanted it or not. But now I know. I belong in those meetings. I belong sitting there. I belong listening and talking to those people who have the same problems I did 25 years ago, who love a man who has a problem with alcohol. And it's quite a job. I thank you very much for listening.
Yay! Get off the podium. What a bad idea. You're standing for you. Huh? Sit him down. Yeah, she's done.
Give me the heads up. I'll be sitting right next to Pat.
Yeah, whenever you tell her I'm done, I'm done.
No, you're done? No, you tell me when you're done. Okay? I had to give you till...
Okay. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 10 o'clock.
Yeah, right.
I'm speaking
for Oh, gosh. They never stop, these alcoholics, do they?
I wanted to sit on the bar stool. Are you going to introduce me? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. I want to introduce... What's his name?
Bob F.
The one thing that I was really nervous about with being chairperson is I didn't know any alcoholics. I knew maybe one or two, but they're still out there drinking. I didn't know any sober ones or recovered ones. And Paul, where is Paul? No, not that Paul, the other Paul. Well, anyway, Paul came up to me at the very first planning meeting, and he gave me this little cute little memo, and it said, here's a speaker. And he made my day, and I called Bob that night, and he and Ellen said, we love Mad Dog Days, we'll be there. So I just want to tell you that he loves us as much as we love him. Here is Bob.
Thanks, Judy.
Okay. Love
you.
Up our podcast too?
Yes. Bob Fisher, alcoholic. Grateful to God and AA for my life and my sobriety today, and I'm a member of the Unity Service and Recovery Group in the San Fernando Valley. And I'm sober 25 years, 3 months, and 5 days. For that, I'm grateful. Nice to be here. Yeah. Can you hear me? Yeah, Ellen heard me 3 days before she met me, for God's sakes. You know, I'll move back another step. You know, I can. You know you're loud when you're loud to yourself. You know, that's the key. Ellen was pretty good. I don't know. I love it. We spoke down at South Bay and a couple of years ago, and she had us getting married in 1890. And there were some newcomers there, and you could see their eyes going in circles, you know. Just don't matter. The story's true. It's the dates, you know. It's like, to protect the innocent, you know. And, oh, Lord. At any rate. I don't know where to begin. You know, I was thinking just the other day. For years we watched that ad about the elephant. You know, and how many of you in Al-Anon have seen the elephant, didn't realize an elephant walking through. But it dawned on me, you know, that I was the elephant, and I didn't know I was an elephant. Didn't know it, you know. And I have a grandson, just turned 3. And about a year ago, he started calling me Popo. And they all thought that was kind of cute, you know. And so I became Popo. And then one day, sitting on my lap, and we're reading one of these animal books, you know. And we turn to, and there's an elephant. And he goes, Popo. And I said, no, that's not Popo, that's elephant. And he went, all right. And then it was a monkey, and he tried to say monkey. And then it was a hippopotamus, and he went, Popo. So now I know that Popo means anything kind of fat and with short legs and a lot of hair, you know, and that's the... So I'm Popo, you know. I got to tell you how I met Ellen. Ellen, when she graduated from the University of Hampshire, her first job was the Young Adult Program Director for the YWCA. And I was living in an apartment house in Binghamton, New York, all with a bunch of young marrieds. And I was the only single guy in there, and I was leading these guys astray because I loved to play shuffleboard in the bars. And none of these guys had ever played shuffleboard in the bars, and I thought that was an embarrassment. How do you tell your grandkids you never played shuffleboard in the bars, for God's sake? So I'd take them out and teach them. And I'd augment my income, and they'd come home drunk, and their wives hated me. And their wives wanted to get me married in the worst way. Any poor single girl moved in that apartment house had to date me, whether they wanted to or not. And so, and I had a series of blind dates. I probably had more blind dates than anybody in the world, you know, because invariably God would fix me up with girls who didn't drink. You know, and girls who don't drink don't date a second time guys who do drink, you know. You know, it just doesn't happen. And girls who didn't drink in those days drank frozen daiquiris or green cream de menthe frappes. You know, and they suck on that one drink all night, which meant they either had green tongues or cold lips. You know what I mean? So anyway, so here I get fixed up with Ellen. YWCA. I figured geez, I got to make room in my car for her tambourine. You know, I didn't know what. But I'd seen her on television. She was tall, willowy brunette, you know, and I, good looking. I figured, oh, good, you know. And so, and the dates were always the same. Binghamton, New York was where I was living at the time. It was my first sales territory. And Binghamton was, at, I don't know what it's like now, but then it wasn't a hot town. You know, 9 o'clock, the sidewalks moved. I mean, they really did. I mean, there was a slow town. And so the dates were always, the blind dates were always to go to the Carlton Hotel for dinner. Well, I'd fill them up on free hors d'oeuvres. They'd be too full to have dinner, and I'd save money. You know, great free hors d'oeuvres. The bartender was a free pourer. You know, and a lot of you know what a free pour is. That's nice about speaking in the desert. You know, Ellen was going to order her green creamed menthe frappe, and then we'd go up to the obligatory movie, and that would be the end of the affair. And we get there, and Ellen orders a scotch and water. My ear began to wiggle a little, you know. By the third round, she's even with me. I'm in lust, for God's sakes. And she says, the hell with the movies. This is fun. Let's stay here. Thank you, God, you know. My prayers have been answered, you know. And we were married in less than a year, you know. And then we did. We moved down in Washington. And, you know, Nancy N. talks about the 60s. Well, her 60s was different than ours. Her 60s were the flutes and the multi-flowers and all those kind of free things, fun things that they did. Our 60s were we're going to go to the moon. And NASA was my main accountant. It was an exciting time. And we drank. I got hired because I could drink. I was at Notre Dame, and I had worked for 4 summers at a place in Teterboro, New Jersey. And my last summer, before my senior year, the sales manager came down and said, I understand you're going to do industrial sales when you graduate. And I said, yes. He said, why don't you apply with us? And I said, well, Ken, you only hire guys who are married or have sold before, and I don't fit either one of those categories. He said, well, we've known you for 4 years, for God's sakes. When are you going to be 21? I said, in February. He said, have you ever been home at Easter? And I said, no, I've never been home at Easter. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll fly you back at my expense, and I'll give you a test. If you pass the test, I'll give you a job offer. If you don't pass the test, no big deal. You'll visit your family and friends and go back to school to graduate. And true to his word, he sent the tickets. I got up to Chicago, flew into Newark Airport. He picked me up. We went to Teterboro, where the plant was. But instead of going to the plant, we went to Bill Odom Saloon and Restaurant on Route 46. And we went in the bar, of course. And we have 6 highballs. That's all we had. We talked about the Brooklyn Dodgers. We talked about Notre Dame football the next year. That's all we talked about. And it's now like 2 o'clock on the East Coast. And he says, Fish, how about lunch? I said, sure. So we started heading out of the bar to go into the dining room. And he says, I hope you take my job offer. And I said, Ken, when do I take the test? He said, you just did. He said, this job requires a lot of drinking. And you're as sober as I am. I need men like you. You know, I was the most dedicated employee that company ever had. So that was my career. I loved drinking. I loved everything about drinking. Even as a little kid, you know, I was raised Irish, of course, and you get a little glass of beer, a glass of wine. I don't remember my first drink, and it doesn't matter. Matter of fact, I was teethed on scotch. I know that for a fact. And my niece was up about 5, 6 years ago with her little kid, and he's teething. I said, Janet, put some scotch on his gums, for God's sake. She says, no, I can't. I said, why? She said, he'll turn out like you. You know. So at any rate, Binghamton, New York was my first sales territory, and that's where I met the golden girl here, you know. And we did. We hit it off fine. And because she never thought I was an alcoholic. I was a heavy, heavy drinker. Oh, you're going to give her water? Please. Yeah. Good. Don't pour it on her. That's all right. What's this half a glass crap? You'd be a lousy bartender. You see that? She poured a nice plastic glass of thing and then poured some of it back because she didn't want the glass full. Oh. I'm glad I didn't marry you, let me tell you. Yeah. I go around and get free coffee, and if they don't fill it, I get mad. You know what I mean? I mean, what is that? What is that about me? You know, so at any rate, we have the 5 for 5. She had 5 kids. I had 4 kids. People say, oh, she was married before. I said, no, you know, it's the nature of my disease. But anyway, this old elephant didn't know I was. I did not know I was an elephant. I really didn't. I was too selfish and self-centered to know I was an elephant. And I was talking with a lady outside, and I hope she's here. I don't see her. But she was saying, well, I'd never been to Al-Anon meetings, but I'd like to go. But they didn't suffer like we did. And I said, oh, you ought to come hear me talk. You ought to come hear me talk. Because this elephant was oblivious to everything, absolutely oblivious. I was also a blackout drinker. Now, a lot of people in this room may not know what the difference is between blacked out and passed out. But blacked out, you're walking, talking, and you sound like a reasonable person. You may be looped, but you sound like you're alive and well, and you're not there. and it'll never come back. It'll never come back. None of my blackouts have ever returned. People say, oh, I remember part of it. I don't remember nothing about my blackouts. I was starting to have daytime blackouts. That's scary. And you'd think somebody with half a brain would do something about it. But I didn't. I figured it was the price to pay. You know, I didn't tie it in with booze being an alcoholic. I had no idea I was an alcoholic. I'd admit to being an Irish drunk, and that was the extent of it. That's as far as I would ever go. But Ellen, in the meantime, Ellen, I get sober. Ellen gets into Al-Anon, and then about 2 months later, she's in Northridge Hospital with bleeding ulcers. And a lot of my AAs thought that was funny. He gets sober and she gets bleeding ulcers. The fact remains that she had had bleeding ulcers for years and didn't know it. She would burn herself on the stove and didn't know it until she could smell the flesh. Now, that's when you turn off all feelings. And so when someone says, the Al-Anons don't feel pain, BS. They've gone past feeling pain, and that's why a lot of them just go loony. You know, living with an alcoholic is no fun. And a lot of people I sponsor don't like to hear that from me. Because usually an alcoholic, when he gets sober, Bob D. says the first thing they get back is his opinion. I disagree. I think the first thing an alcoholic gets back when he gets sober is feeling sorry for himself. You know, that's why, you know, a lot of Al-Anons will pray, I hope this alcoholic gets sober. And then they're looking at this sober alcoholic who's not drinking. He's the meanest, most miserable SOB in the world. They're saying, that was a dumb prayer. You know, I wish he'd pass out just once, you know, just, oh, maybe I could. And Ellen kind of skipped over. She got to that point where she was going to divorce me. She didn't tell you the whole story. Maybe some of you remember. There was a great play, Alfred Hitchcock, where this lady kills her husband with a frozen leg of lamb. Kills him. Frozen leg of lamb, puts it in the oven, so when the cops get there, they can have roast lamb. They ate the evidence. You know what I mean? Ellen wasn't quite that good, but where she was, she got her master's degree in psychology, and now she was taking some coursework down at UCLA, actually USC, Andrews School of Gerontology, on sleep apnea. This is 1977, okay? Sleep apnea. And I snored a lot. I snored so loud, my kids would tape me. Well, that's not a bad deal, but they'd tape me down three bedrooms around a corner. And they'd bring their friends over to laugh at the old man snoring, you know. And they thought it was funny. And Ellen says, snoring. So what her plan was, and it's a good plan, so be good to your spouse. Her plan was this, and it would work. She was going to put a pillow on my head and sit on it. And tell people I snored myself to death, you know. So the USR group knows from now on, if I die suddenly, they got to check for feathers in my lungs. You know what I mean? Now that was a good plan, sleep apnea. Jeez, you know, think about it. Yeah. Anyway, that first year being sober is no romance for anybody. It's terrible for the alcoholic. I mean, I was 3 months still itching in weird places you couldn't get at with a knife. My hands, you know, AAs would always end the meeting with that Lord's Prayer, you know, and they'd want to hold hands. And I knew the reason they wanted to hold hands, nothing to do with holding hands. It had to do to find out who the newcomer was who didn't raise their hand because my hands were still soaking wet. And you can't get up to say the Lord's Prayer and dry your hands off to make believe you're new. You know what I mean? You got some time. You know what I mean? It was just terrible, chaotic. And my mind was racing and it wasn't going anywhere. You know, just digging a circle somewhere, and I was oblivious to life. I truly was. And Ellen saw no great romance suddenly coming out of my sobriety. It just isn't there. You know, it's a weird time. Thank God for Al-Anon, because she was going to her meetings, I was going to my meetings. And her sponsor had said, no major decisions for the first year. And in your case, Ellen, 2 years. You know, and slowly but surely, you know, we began to heal, both of us. And humor came back into the family. And that family of ours, we had the four kids. My oldest son had just started UCLA, and he had packed everything he ever wanted and was never coming home. Number two was using my tree as a bathroom. And I thought that was kind of gross. It was my tree. He should, you know, in the front yard. That's not a good place. You know, number three son was badly dyslexic and a wonderful, brilliant guy, but he was all mixed up, and because living with an alcoholic ain't going to make anybody happy. But also living with a future Al-Anon isn't. Because if you had asked my kids, who was the least sane person in the house, Ellen or I, Ellen won. Because living with the alcoholic, she was up and down like an elevator. I was just good old Mr. Regular. You know, be home, I'd be drunk, you know, sleeping or whatever I was doing. But I was the same. You know, I just day in, day out. I was a daily drunk, you know. But Ellen was an elevator. And so the kids thought I was okay, you know, because they understood that. Not sad. That's how sad life can be sometimes. But that family was disrupted. It wasn't a family. It was just a group of six individuals all seeking some kind of relief, and it's just something, you know. And my poor daughter, she was the future Al-Anon of America. She was putting Band-Aids on everybody, trying to make everything sweet and nice. And she couldn't. She couldn't. And then Al-Anon, thank God, grabbed Ellen. AA grabbed me, and my sponsor grabbed me. I was sober 3 months. 6 months. I was sober 6 months, and I'm at my must meeting at that time, which is a Monday night meeting in Granada Hills. And a bunch of us peer group guys, all about 6 months sober, were standing together and lamenting the fact that the newcomers had it easier than us. You know, and... that's all right. It's an AA joke. And... and somehow the conversation got around to, we get our wives coffee. And I don't know about you, but I've always felt that the one thing missing in most alcoholics is a bungee cord attached to our tongues. Because it would hurt the roof of your mouth, but it would sure be better on 10 steps. You know what I mean? Because I said something stupid. You know, I didn't, but my peer group laughed, whatever, but it was obviously a put down in Ellen. To this day, I don't know what I said. But when he said, do we get our wives coffee, I said something stupid. And he looked at me, and the group peer group laughed, and he looked at me, and he started walking the other way. Now, I didn't come into AA to get sober. I came into AA to get the heat off. And thanks to guys like my sponsor and about 8 or 10 other men in the valley, I wanted to earn their respect. And to earn their respect, you had to do what they did. And so I was in that earning their respect phase. Still not thinking AA was going to be some lifetime thing for me, but I wanted to earn his respect. And off he went to the corner. And I went running up to him. And I said, Dave, did I say something stupid? And he said, Bob, he says, you know, you're unwilling to move on the steps. You don't even, you keep lying to me about step four, for God's sakes. But you've told me enough about the life that your wife had to live with you. He said, if you can't do a simple act of kindness, like get your wife coffee in the morning, you're no kind of man that I want to know. So the next night, I got home that night from the meeting, and I made the coffee up ahead of time. And the next morning, poor Ellen's probably trying to sleep in, and I'm saying, wake up, Dave says I got to bring your coffee, you know. But I still bring her coffee, you know. I was sober about 9 months, and he asked me if I listened to my kids as well as I listened to newcomers. And I said, yes, I do. And he says, I don't think you heard the question. And he was right. He was dead on right, because I was still that caveman. You know, I'd act like I was an AA when I was an AA. I'd even act good when I was driving, because I never knew who was watching me. But when I was at home, it was my cave, man. Do as I say, not as I do, that kind of stuff. I was the caveman. And I was treating those kids, I was giving them no respect. When Don Locke talks always about the back rub, I love it. Because it reminds me that most of us miss in the 11-step prayer, that you can't get respect until you give it first. And I wasn't giving my kids any respect. They weren't kids. I mean, these kids were just a few years away from Social Security, for God's sakes. They were. By now, they're 17 to 21, you know. I mean, they're adults, and I'm still telling them what to do. You know, so that changed, thanks to my sponsor. Ellen's sponsor made her take the traditions home. We had to start bringing the traditions home, and Ellen didn't think that was a smart idea because she knew what was best for the family. And so she thought she'd try it out, this group conscience thing, on a Christmas dinner, and it came to a vote. This was her first thing on traditions, and she said, do you want turkey or do you want roast beef for Christmas? And the vote was 5-1, and she was the one. And so she became a believer in the traditions at home, and the kids were raised on that. You know, and slowly but surely, with the respect, thanks to sponsorship, that family became a family. You know, it's a close family. It really was. You know, when Ellen had that stroke, two of the kids were married, were way up north. And within hours, they got some kind of crazy planes, and they were there. Hell, they were there within 4 hours from up in Northern California. Just amazing, yeah. And that family is healed today. That oldest guy who went away to UCLA, never coming back, he did come back. And thank God, you know. And he had scored very well in the LSATs, very well. And so he went east to go visit law schools. And he came back, and his Al-Anon mother says, well, which law school have you picked? He said, well, he said, I'd like all of them. I'd go to all of them. He said, matter of fact, I'd love to go to law school. But I don't want to be a lawyer. He said, I've talked to these lawyers. That can't be a good job. She said, well, what do you want to do? He said, well, I want to be a writer. And she said, how are you going to earn a living while you're learning to write? He said, oh, I'll be a bartender. You think that's funny? One of my dreams was to have a kid as a bartender. Now I go up to the Universal Sheraton. Want another dad? Yeah, black coffee. Thanks, Bob. You know, I mean, terrible. Son number two, we didn't throw him out of the house. We just quadrupled his rent, you know. And he found out he could rent a house. Because we had heard a speaker the day before, a good friend of mine, Gary C., who talked about if his parents had bailed him out one more time, he'd be dead today. And we weren't bailing this guy out. He was working and still in a school. Well, he didn't go to school. He went to Pierce, and he'd take six courses a semester. And then he would strategically withdraw from each course about every week. And so that each semester he'd ended with a participation in golf. That was it, you know. But he was always a hardworking guy. And he had my thirst and Ellen's hangovers. I mean, it was the worst combination. You know, he deserved it. You know, he really did, you know. So we got him out of the house because he was drugging and dealing and all that kind of stuff. And we didn't think we should be helping him to pay for it. And he did. He went on his way. He did his thing. And about 4 years later, he met a girl who didn't drink. And he changed his life, you know. He was a guy who was probably just a heavy drinker and a dumb doper. You know, one of those combinations. Yeah, because he straightened his life out. And it's been a pleasure to be around him. And son number three, the guy with the dyslexia, he had to find his. We had gone through all kinds of training stuff. But brilliant guy, brilliant. He couldn't, he still reads at about an eighth grade level. But in spite of all the training, it never had a breakthrough, you know. But he found his own way to learn. He went to college, and after college, he graduated from UC Santa Cruz, and then he built a brew pub. Two of them. People said, how's his beer? How do I know? Good old God, laughing again, you know. Have a coffee, Dad. Thanks, Mike, you know. God, his humor, you know. And then he had this brew pub, and everybody, all the vendors were making money, but he and his two partners weren't making a nickel. So he said, the hell with this, and he went to law school, and now he's a lawyer, you know. So, you know, goes to show you never know, you know. The daughter, God love her, she got married, met a wonderful guy, you know, and they have two kids. We have grandchildren now. At one time, up until Ellen's stroke, we had no grandchildren. It was 2001 she had it, by the way. I think she said 1991, but that's all right. It doesn't matter. 10 years here or there. You know, so we had no grandchildren. And Ellen and I were lamenting the fact we had no grandchildren. And I said, honey, maybe we have to make our own. She said, there better be a star in the East, fella, you know. So anyway, last Friday night, Ellen and I are sitting in the pool, with six of our grandchildren and our kids. And we're swimming at night, you know, with the lights on. And somebody says, how's your day going? That's a great day. That's truly a great day. We're blessed, you know. Life is good. Life is good. Do I have time? I don't know. What time is it? Oh, yeah, I got time. Is it 2 o'clock yet? No, it isn't. It's 2 o'clock. I said I'd squint. All right, real fast. I retired early, not because I wanted to, but because they closed the division. I wound up going to work for the blind. I figured a good friend of mine was running the school for the blind, and he was blind himself. And I said, you know, I've never been patient, never believed that patience was a virtue. I felt that most people who were patient were boring. And, you know, but I realized I needed patience. And so I figured I'll go with the blind. Other than Joe, they're all, I'm sure, blind people are patient. Found out they're as impatient as I am. Absolutely as impatient as me, but they have one skill I never had or never tried to have, and that is the act of acting as if I have patience. And so I learned from the blind to act as if I have patience. So that truly is a virtue. I then wound up working at a retirement home with the Alzheimer's people, and I had an opportunity to be with them. And I'd take them on bus trips on Saturday, and the guys in my group would laugh at me because we'd go to different places. And they'd say, well, why do you go to different places? They don't remember where they've been. I said, that's true, but they know when they're there, they're having fun. They know when they're there, they're having fun. And again, I met a guy there whose mother kept calling him Uncle Clarence, and Uncle Clarence had been dead many years, and this guy was upset, and he was my age. He was late 60s at the time, and he's crying, and I got him some coffee, and I said, can't you act as if you're Uncle Clarence? I said, your mother obviously loved this guy. You obviously look like him somewhat. He says, no, I'm not Uncle Clarence. I'm her son. I said, yeah, you know it, and I know it, but she doesn't. I said, can't you act as if I'm Uncle Clarence? And he said, no. The blessings of these programs, how they teach us early on to act as if. You know, and what a great gift that is, you know. This is a gifted program. And early on, I've got to say this just for Deborah. I was asked, what is the first promise in AA? By a guy who really wanted to know what was going on in your life. And he said, how are things going? And I told him a lot more than I've told you. And he said, what's the first promise in AA? And I said, well, new freedom and happiness. He said, yeah, that's true. He says, but a lot of us think the first real promise is in that paragraph before where Bill's talking about step nine. If we're painstaking with this phase of our development, step nine, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. And a lot of us think that this program, the first promise is being amazed. And he said, what you've told me about your life, you're amazed that it's working. In spite of your ego, in spite of your everything else, this program is working and you're giving credit to AA and to this higher power in your life. And he said, but equally amazing are guys in your peer group who haven't made more than you do are no longer amazed at AA, no longer amazed at the higher power. They're now amazed at how well they are doing. They're now back in the big bed. They have some money. The phone call rings and they can pick it up. They don't need AA anymore. And they're in that mystery group, those guys between 5 and 10 at the countdown tomorrow who aren't going to be standing up. We're going to need AA. My God, I hope we all stay amazed. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.